And me. Good afternoon. How are you? It's wonderful to be here at Club Hour here at the Barron campus in this newly restored, beautiful Koch Auditorium. So first of all, I'm very excited about today's shiur. I'm very excited to find out what it's going to be about because I had the great schus of spending Shabbos with Stern College at some campsite in the middle of nowhere. Camp Dina. Was anybody there? People were there. So then I realized that the title I gave for the shiur was the exact same shiur that I gave at the camp. So I said to myself, I can't do that. So I came up with a new shiur. So I have the new shiur, and I, this morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, came up with it, emailed it, and then I just got downstairs, and I see that in the series for Club Hour, that Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberg's topic is very similar to my topic, which was just last week. So this will be a combination of today's shiur, what was almost today's shiur, what will be another type of shiur, and everybody, I'm sure, will get something out of it, but I apologize if there's any repetition, especially if you heard from a gadol and a gon, and let's be honest, a guy with a much, much, much better beard than me, Rav Moshe Tzvi Weinberg. It's funny, I'm a rabbi in Passaic, and I was once giving a tshuva shiur opposite another very, very, very prominent world-class Rosh Hashiva. And it happens to be a lot of the people came to my shiur, and not as many people came to his shiur. So the president of his shul came to me and said to me, I don't understand. You know, I mean, he didn't realize how insulting he was being, but said to me, I don't understand, you know, how come the people came to your shiur and not this person's shiur? This person's such a big personality. They're such a great tzaddik. They're such a great gon. You grew up in Los Angeles. You're already puzzled from Leda. We don't even know what to do with you. So I said to him, you have to understand something. And that is that Rabbi so-and-so may be a bigger expert in tshuva, but I am a bigger expert in chet. And sometimes when you have the perspective of what's going on in your reality, sometimes you could connect with people in a very different way. So that's what I want to talk to you about today. And that is the journey of tshuva, the journey of what it is to confront the reality of who we are. We would all love to be the greatest people in the world. We would all love to be tzaddikim and tzadkonios and all the different, but most of us who live life are confronting over the course of the period of Elul the general challenges that we have, the general experiences that we have, and we're trying to make a roshem on ourselves, make a greater impact on ourselves, and so that's what we're going to talk about today. So let's begin. So if you turn to source number one in our packet is from the tour. And the tour captures a very, very well-known minhag that we have throughout the month of Elul. We know that when Elul begins, there's a certain sense of emotionality that is introduced into the rhythm of Jewish life. And that emotionality expresses itself in different forms, depending on who you're talking to, who you're listening to, who you're connecting with. For some people, it is a very daunting, fearful, terrorizing emotionality. We have the Elul Shiurim that got the lightning bolts, that's got, you know, you never know what's going to happen. I was telling the women over Shabbos that this past summer, our family took a 2-week cross-country trip in an RV. We rented a 30-foot RV, and we drove from Passaic to Los Angeles, straight across the United States of America. And it was absolutely amazing. And where did we sleep? We slept in RV parks across the United States with the chevra that live in RV parks. Many, many, many of them are not alumni of Stern College or even Sims School of Business. Okay? This is a totally different sector of America that you are probably not used to or exposed to. A totally different chevra. But everybody's very friendly. One of the things you discover when you drive across the United States is pretty much from Pittsburgh to Phoenix, everyone is nice. right? So everyone is friendly. You get there, you don't know what to do, and they help you. And I remember one of the nights that we were in Kansas, there was a tremendous storm. And we're sleeping in this RV, and everything turns into a bed in an RV. The table's a bed, the loft is a bed, the bench becomes a bed, the bed is a bed. People sleeping everywhere, hanging off the thing. We're sleeping, and in Kansas, these storms are not like they are in New York and New Jersey, a little flash of lightning. It's like 2 hours straight of lightning and wind and rain, and it's momish like, and I'm sitting there and I say to my wife, you know, how often do you turn on the news and you hear there were storms in Kansas? Don't worry, they didn't do much damage in the cities, but they wiped out RV parks, right? I'm like, we're in the RV park, right? So sometimes you think of Elul, and this is the scene you think of. You think of the storm of emotions that pours forth when an individual begins to confront their mortality, when an individual begins to confront their reality, when you begin to contemplate the absolute cosmic realities of what it means to be judged by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so there's a certain sense of fear. For some, Elul becomes a platform of opportunity to be able to reflect, to be able to refine, to be able to move forward in a more positive disposition, more of an Avas Hashem type approach. The emotionality of Elul is very diverse, and there is no one perfect recipe for what the constellation of feelings and emotions should be as you approach Yomim Noraim. It's individualized to your own particular dynamics of Avodas Hashem, to your personality, to communal context, and often to where you are in your life. Sometimes you're in a space in your life where you're confronting everything that's wrong. Sometimes you're in a space in your life where you need to be internalizing and understanding and building on everything that's right. And it's a balance and it's a challenge. But when Elul begins, the one fundamental truth that transverses all different approaches to how you reach this world of Yamim Noraim is that there has to be a shift in mindset, a shift in perspective. There is an awakening. Something happens. The values of Elul and of Tshuva are extant and true throughout the year. In Nisan, also the concepts of Tshuva are true. But there is one point of the year that is endowed with this disposition towards change, which what the Navi describes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is closer to us, he's accessible to us, and there is an atmosphere, there is a tone, there is a feeling, there's a sensation, and it saturates our spiritual, religious, and material lives that positions us to be able to do something different, to be able to actually make a change. That's what our new year is about, right? In the larger world, when they celebrate the new year, they have a concept of new year resolutions, and they party. We're excited that it's a new year. We have a more somber, reflective sense of aspiration that frames our new year. So says the tour, what happens in Elul to evoke that sense of awakening, to essentially motivate us, to propel ourselves forward in taking on this approach? Says the tour, we have the minug to blow the shofar. Tanya bepirkei derabbi Eliezer, birosh chodesh Elul omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe. So where does this come from, that we blow the shofar at the beginning of Elul? Because the truth is, it's quite counterintuitive. In Judaism in general, we like to endow mitzvos with a tremendous amount of excitement and enthusiasm when we encounter their observance. We do not eat matzah on Erev Pesach. We do not do mitzvos in anticipation of what we're going to ultimately reach. We want to reach those experiences with an apex of intensity, with a sense of climactic energy that brings us to the mitzvah experience. So it's very strange that even though Rosh Hashanah is so defined by this mitzvah of Tekiyah Shofar, that in anticipation of Rosh Hashanah, we already begin to evoke not just the imagery of the shofar, but the experience of the shofar. And the Pirkei de Eliezer writes, why is that so? Why at the beginning of Elul? Why not wait till Rosh Hashanah? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the first day of Elul, God tells Moshe, Ola, Olai, Hahara, I want you to come up this mountain, ascend the mountain, she'az ala lekabel luchos achronos, that at that moment Moshe Rabbeinu goes up the mountain to accept the second luchos, v'heviru shofar b'machaneh. And they blew the shofar within the camp. Moshe ala lahar shelo yitou od achar avodah zarah. Let's remember what happened the last time Moshe Rabbeinu went up. Right? The last time Moshe Rabbeinu went up, in the midst of all the ambiguity and confusion of when he was supposed to come back, the Jewish people who had just been emancipated from Mitzrayim and had literally witnessed Nisim and Niflos on the Yam Suf, the Jewish people succumbed to the temptation that Moshe Rabbeinu was no longer with them, devoid of that anchor of faith and leadership. And in the midst of all of that chaos, they actually violate one of the most significant Isurim imaginable. They worship Avodah Zarah. They build the golden calf. Last year in my shul, on Parshas Kisisa, I like to try to find ways to make shul more exciting. So last year in Parshas Kisisa, when we were reading the Parsha of the Chet HaEgel, so I usually speak after the Kriyas HaTorah, before Musaf. So what happened was, they were putting away the Torah, and I went outside the shul, ki'ilu, I was using the restroom, and I hid in the back of my office. And I did not tell a single soul where I was going. Not the gabbai, not the chazen, not anybody in the building. Regrettably, I also didn't tell my wife, which we will see soon, almost made my shana achrona of marriage. So what happened was, I hid in my office. They put away the Torah, chadei shameinu kekedem, and everybody's like, where's the rabbi? They start looking around the room, no rabbi. They check the men's room, no rabbi. They're looking for the rabbi, and then it starts. What should we do? Should we keep davening? Should we put someone else up to speak? Should we fire the rabbi? No rabbi. So I let this go on for a good 5 minutes. I also have Hatzolah guys in my shul. I don't know if you're familiar with this. These are people who have an enormous amount of emergency medical training and an enormous amount of keys. And between these two elements, they are able to handle any emergency. These guys have already put search groups. They're all over the building. Finally, I walk back in to the shul, and everybody's talking, and everybody, blah, 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 blah. And I walk up to the bima, and I just look at the shul, and I say to them, how disconcerting it is when you expect a leader to be there and he doesn't show up. Look what happens. Some of you wanted to skip the sermon. Some of you are ready to build an egel, to worship Avodah Zarah, to literally position a piece of kugel as your future leader of your congregation. And this was our experiential moment that we had in the shul. So I didn't tell my wife, so she was very scared and very worried, and that's why they don't let me give Shalom Bayis classes. So what happens? So Moshe Rabbeinu is missing, the Jewish people build an egel, and now, as we discussed over Shabbos, you're going to have the exact same circumstances again, and there's a certain sense of fear, there's a certain sense of trepidation. How are the Jewish people going to react to these circumstances? So in order to strengthen, in order to edify Klal Yisrael's sense of faith in the Rabbonu Shalom, in Moshe, in themselves, we blew the shofar as an expression of our emotive connection to the transcendent reality that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to get the Luchos Shnios, and that's what we commemorate during Elul. It's really fascinating, if you think about it, the contrast between the event that the shofar evokes in the beginning of Elul and the event that the shofar evokes on Rosh Hashanah itself. On Rosh Hashanah itself, we bring the shofar, why? To say to God, hey, don't you remember what we were willing to do? Don't you remember that fateful day on Har HaMoriah when Avram Avinu was willing to literally sacrifice his son, his dream, his legacy, his future in deference to your will. Don't you remember we were prepared to surrender everything to your tzivui, to your command? That's why we bring up the shofar. That's what this, it says in the Machzor. It says in the Machzor, we raise the shofar because we want to say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, look, this is a symbol of our loyalty to you. It's a symbol of our spiritual success. It's a symbol of our spiritual endurance. It's a symbol of the fact that we are your people and no matter what, we're with you. That's the shofar of Rosh Hashanah. What's the shofar of Elul? It's so peculiar. It's the shofar of we messed up. It's the shofar of failure. It's the shofar to remember the fact that we couldn't get it right. That God told the Jewish people, Moshe Rabbeinu's coming back, and at the slightest sense of aberration from the original plan, we immediately lose faith in everything. And this is the shofar that we evoke to launch this period of the year where we're trying to be reflective, where we're trying to be restorative to our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is the shofar of Elul, the shofar of the Luchos Shnios, the shofar of failure, the shofar of the collapse of the Jewish people's moral fortitude in the face of just not even knowing what's happening. That's what you want to bring to God at the beginning of Elul. It's so strange. You're ruining the anticipation. You're bringing up something. En kategor nase sanegor. You know, we have rules. We don't bring gold into certain contexts. We don't bring gold into the Kodesh HaKadosh. Why? We don't want to remind God of the Chet HaEgel. We don't bring gold under a chuppah. Why? We don't want to remind God of the Chet HaEgel. We don't bring Ein Kategor Nase Sanegor. We don't want, in the context of defending ourselves, to introduce evidence that is ultimately supportive to the prosecutor. And yet, at the very beginning of Elul, what do? We say, hey God, I want you to remember the Chet HaEgel? Remember that in take two it went okay? That's what we want to remind you of. That's what you want to remind them of. Remind them of moments that we made it happen. Remind them of moments where things were great. That's our question. And what's interesting is this entire episode of the Chet HaEgel itself is a very, very fascinating moment in the Torah. Because as the Medrash tells us in source number 3, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he comes down and he sees the Jewish people having this party around an Avodah Zarah. It wasn't just that they worshipped Avodah Zarah. It was that it was done in the context with passion, with enthusiasm, with excitement. It was like an Avodah Zarah Karbach Minyan. It was more than just Avodah Zarah. It was like they were super into it. They were like, they had a band. I remember in California, we used to have a camp that was run by Bnei Akiva called Mosh Choref. I don't know if you have this on the East Coast, but in California, we didn't have a winter, right? We had earthquakes, but we didn't have a winter. Earthquakes much better than a winter, because winter is like 6 months of snow. Earthquake, it's 60 seconds. You're either dead and you're not dead. You move on with your life. So what happens? So we used to have a camp where we would all go to the mountains in Big Bear and do wintry things. We would go skiing and we would go snow tubing because there was snow up there, all the way in the mountains. So I used to play the Moshe Choref. I was the band. So I used to go up there. I was a professional keyboard player. And I remember one of the themes one year was Kabbalah Satorah. And they wanted to do a recreation of the Chet HaEgel. So they asked me that when the Moshe, the person representing Moshe, would come down from the hill, whatever they were doing, that I should play music that was appropriate for an idolatrous party, right? An idolatrous party. So to get people into it, it shouldn't just be that we worship the Egel. There's a sense of excitement. There's a sense of enthusiasm. So says the Medrash, Moshe Rabbeinu sees all of this. And what's his reaction? It's a very strange reaction. He doesn't give the Jewish people Musar. He doesn't tell them they did something wrong. He doesn't do anything towards them. What does he do? He takes the object that has nothing to do with this collapse of their commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nothing. He takes the object that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him. The object of the luchos that are a symbol of purity, that are a symbol of commitment, that are a symbol of command. And what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He breaks these luchos. And that was a very bold thing for Moshe Rabbeinu to do. Who told you you could break the luchos? God wrote these luchos. Who told you you could break the luchos? So the Medrash writes very explicitly, and the Gemara says this as well. The Medrash writes, it's in source number 3. Lo amar le'akadosh baruch hu lishbor es haluchos, olach Moshe b'shivron me'atzmo. God did not tell him to do this. Moshe breaks the luchos on his own. Uminayin shehiskim akadosh baruch hu imo dichsiv, as it says, how do you know that God acquiesced, that he agreed, that he affirmed, that he validated that Moshe did the right thing? Asher shibarta yasher koach sheshibarta. Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, you did absolutely the right thing by breaking the luchos. Not only does Moshe Rabbeinu do the right thing by breaking the luchos, but the Torah tells us at the end of Sefer Devarim, in the very, very final psukim of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, those very emotional psukim where we've been with Moshe Rabbeinu since the beginning of Shmos, and we've been with him all the parashios, and now we're sitting there on Simchas Torah, and the Torah says, "Vayomas Shah Moshe," that Moshe Rabbeinu dies, and then the Torah gives us a few psukim of a hesped for Moshe Rabbeinu that are meant to capture his accomplishments, his achievements, his legacy for the Jewish people. And the Torah tells us in the very last pasuk in the Torah, "Ulechol ayara chazakol lechol amora hagadol," all of the great miracles and wonders that Moshe Rabbeinu was able, Asher Asa Moshe, that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to facilitate, le'enei kol Yisrael, before the entire Jewish people. Now, if I was a Rishon, I would say, what does this refer to? Shibud Mitzrayim and getting out of Mitzrayim, Kriyas Yamsuf, all the miracles of the Man, the miracles of the Be'er, the construction of the Mishkan, the defeat of Korach, the defeat of Bilam, the wars that Moshe Rabbeinu helped them win, so many different amazing moments. What does Rashi say, the very last Rashi in the Torah? Source number 5. What is Le'enei Kol Yisrael? Those last words of the entire Torah. What do they refer to, says Rashi? Shenoso libo l'shaber es haluchos le'eneihem. That Moshe Rabbeinu had the intuition to go ahead and break the luchos in front of the Jewish people. And the question is, that's Moshe's legacy? That's it? That's what you want the Jewish people? That's what you want in the New York Times, the final byline to be? Moshe Rabbeinu, breaker of luchos? This is what you tell me? This is his essence? How is this such a significant and central component of the development of the Jewish people that again, we would raise the specter of failure as seemingly a hallmark accomplishment of one of our greatest leaders? Why do we start Elul with the shofar of failure? Why is Shmiras Haluchos so central to the identity of the Jewish people? Why does it become so much the foundation of Moshe Rabbeinu's legacy? So to answer that question, we turn to a very beautiful and amazing section of Rav Soloveitchik's Al HaTshuva. Rav Soloveitchik's Al HaTshuva, which is really a summary of many of the drushos that he gave in source number 6, says the following very critical point about Tshuva. He says that there are two pathways to how a person can address their shortcomings, their failures, their sins, and their challenges. One pathway is what he writes, is bir hara, is the expulsion of what's bad. Life is about grasping for purity and tahara and sanctity, and anything that is present in our environment or spiritual landscape that stands in contrast to the nobility of those goals is automatically something that has to be removed and expelled. That's the goal. The goal is to take anything that's bad and destroy it. Says the Rav, there's another approach to how to relate to failure and challenges. And that is Haderech Hashniyah, on the right side of the first column, tikun hara ha'elotu. That the way in which you address failure is not to expel it, is not even to remove it, it's to elevate it. And Rav Soloveitchik goes on to explain so beautifully, this is a Gemara that we actually quoted in another context over Shabbos, that we know that we're told that the process of tshuva, when done correctly, can actually not only address the negativity of our failures, but could transform those failures into zechuyos themselves, right? That when a person does tshuva, tshuva me'ahava, the Gemara says, your zidonos are nasa kishkados, your shkados are nasa kishkuyos. Almost nobody here has done a zidonos. A zidonos is when you do something that is rebellious. You do something that is intentionally rebellious. Zidonos does not mean you succumb to temptation, you grew up in a certain way and certain things are just habitual to you. Zidonos means hineni muchon umizumon lekayem avera hazeh, and you sing it. Hineni muchon umizumon, right? And then you eat a cheeseburger. That is zidonos. That's difficult. Most of us, what we're going to be doing tshuva for, most of us are going to be doing tshuva, almost all of us probably in this room, are going to be doing tshuva for shgagos. Shgagos means we messed up. We messed up. We messed up for a variety of reasons. We didn't mess up because we hate God. We didn't mess up because we hate Judaism. We didn't mess up because we hate the Torah. Somewhere within the recesses of our soul is an inner desire, an inner will, an inner ratzon to do the right thing. We want to do the right thing. But things happen. Situations happen, circumstances happen, environments happen, influences happen, and we end up veering off course. One of the things that the Jewish people is very good at is attributing highly intentional and horrible, sense of motivation to people who are very often just lost. They're lost. They may not look lost. They may seem like they know what they're saying. They may be saying it with a lot of confidence. They may be saying it with a lot of eloquence and articulation. And you feel like, this person, they're really... But in reality, if you break it down, they're a product of their environment. They're a product of their home. They're a product of their circumstance. You don't know what's going on in their life and what kind of challenges end up influencing a person. Most of our mistakes, most of the things that we do wrong are b'shogeg. We didn't mean to do these things wrong. And if we do tshuva the right way, says the Gemara, then the shogegos can be naseh kishuyos. They actually become merits, which means the more you did wrong, the more credit you'll get. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, how is that possible? How is that possible? That's a ridiculous cheshbon. Who's ever heard of such a thing, right? When my kids do something wrong, and they come to me to apologize, they come to me to fess up, I'm proud of the apology. I'm proud that they said they did something wrong. I'm proud that they recognize it, that they realize it. But I'm going to reward them for it. I'm going to tell them it's a schus. I think it's great. I'm going to give you an extra, you were hiding in your room watching MLB when you were supposed to be studying or supposed to be asleep. And I should be like, well, since you came to me and apologized, so now we're good to go, right? I'm going to give you credit, mamish, for what's going on. I remember when I was in high school, I was a horrible driver. And we used to get licenses in LA at 16 years old. And I got a license and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I caused at least 5 accidents in the first 6 months. Hit a deaf guy, whatever. So what happened was, there was this situation in my neighborhood where I pulled into a driveway and another woman was pulling into a driveway, and let's say it was a Nagia Shalom Bederechiba, the two cars. There was connection. So my father said to me, listen, I don't want the insurance rates to go up. They already went up from the 5-car pileup you caused in Phoenix. So let's try to keep this under control. Let's go sit down with these people and see if we can make a deal. So we go to their house one night. My father, whatever, we exchanged information at the accident. And we agree and we sit down, and I am a very, very arrogant 16-year-old boy. And I, of course, come in with the driver's manual, and I start explaining why I did nothing wrong, right? How I ended up in her driveway, in the front of her car. I had a whole complicated, it involved a FedEx truck 3 blocks away, and it was a good, this is why, you know, guys learn, you know? Like, I had a lot of lumdis of exactly how to get there. Anyway, this woman went psycho, totally crazy. Screaming, yelling, throwing things, like totally crazy. And my father just sat there. And when she was done with her outburst, my father looked at her and she said, "You know, ma'am, I have to tell you, when my son told me what happened, I didn't really believe a word he said." And I'm like, "Thanks, Dad. But now I see how crazy you are. I think I'm going to back him. And so we'll let it go to the insurance companies, right? You do something wrong, you take responsibility. You do something wrong, you deal with the consequences. You don't do something wrong because you decide to handle it well, all of a sudden you're a tzaddik, you're a great driver. No, he took my license away for 3 months, right? You don't get rewarded for that," says the Rav, something so, so powerful. Says the Rav, look at this, he says, and if you look at the second column, he says, "You know what? We have to ask ourselves, what does it mean?" He describes it as an ani. What does it mean to have a personal identity? Who are you? Who are you? Asks the Rav. And the Rav says, "I'll tell you who you are. Not who are we, who are you? Who am I?" Right? "Who are you?" says the Rav. "You are a product of your background and life experiences, and you are a product of your aspirations and what you intend to ultimately accomplish and ultimately do." So says the Rav, when a person looks at there, and he says it so beautifully, look at the first column, on the left column, on source number 6. "Hazikaron meishe l'she'ela shal mi ani, who am I? Ani hu zeh sheyesh li zikaron, I have memories, and I have rigashot, I have feelings, kach v'kach chavayot, these experiences, kach v'kach smachot, v'kach v'kach itzvonot, I have great things, celebrations that happen, tragedies that happen. B'zikaron nimsheches ritzifas ha'ani. And in my memory lives the continuum of my identity. B'tfila anu omrim. And in tfila, what do we say? We say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ata zocher ma'asei olam. We bring all these memories with us into our tefillah because our goal ultimately is to reflect, is to analyze, is to deal with, is to confront everything that's happened. Because we're trying to confront the essence of who we are. And if we don't confront what we've been through, our past, we can't really confront with integrity and authenticity who we are. You can't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to be different. You have to ask yourself, what was 5779? What happened? Where did I succeed? Where did I fail? Where did I confront challenge? Where did I embrace success? Where did I miss opportunities? Where did I take advantage of them? If you can't reflect on how you got here, you're missing such a foundational component of what's here. You are. That's the definition. That's who you are. You're what your experiences have been. So when you bring yourself into Yamim Noraim, you're bringing those experiences, you're bringing that past. So says the Rav, on one hand, you're defined by who you are. On the other hand, says the Rav, what really determines your trajectory? What really determines what ultimately your impact in life will be? What really determines what your home will look like, what your family will look like, what all of the different choices you make, what ultimately shapes that is how you relate to your choices and decisions moving forward and into the future. So says Rabbi Soloveitchik, a chote, a sinner, has two choices. One choice is to somehow edit out the past. To edit out the past, but says the Rav so beautifully, if you do that, then you edit out a piece of who you are. Because who we are is also shaped by where we fail. And it's also shaped by how we react to failure. and how we grow from failure, and how we learn from failure, and how we overcome failure. And you can't bifurcate those two things. You can't say, I want to expel any remnant of anything I did wrong, but all of the positive outcomes of those experiences, the growth that I experienced, the lessons I learned, the way in which I internalized that experience to allow me to become a better person and move forward, that I want to hold on to. Says the Rav, it doesn't work that way. They're connected. They're organically connected. Our mistakes and our potential are one and the same. It's how we grow. It's how we change. It's how we evolve. It's how we move forward. If you can't look at where you were to determine where to go, then you're missing the whole foundation of your identity. You can't erase and edit those parts out. My kids made a vlog of our trip. A vlog. And it was it's like a series of videos that they took over the trip. And they edited and put in music and all sorts of things. But they didn't include any of the things that went wrong. So you watch this thing and you think, this was the most amazing trip in the world. Nothing ever went wrong. When in reality, our fridge broke, the transmission broke, I was on the phone with the guy who was telling me to fix the air filter, which I didn't even know what an air filter was, right? All these things that went wrong. But all these things that went wrong were also part of what brought everyone together. We're also part of the experience. We're also part of giving us that stamina and that sense of resilience to be able to move forward together as a family, they're part of what made the amazing parts more magical, was transcending the challenges. Says the Rav, you have two choices with your mistakes. You can edit them, or you can elevate them. And when a person elevates them, when a person consecrates them, when a person realizes that, yes, I made some bad decisions, I made some bad choices, I reacted to temptation, but I got something from it. It's not that you terminate what went wrong and you start new. What went wrong becomes part of what it means to be new. And that's what the Torah says. The Medrash tells us in source number 7, an amazing thing. Rabbi Rav Yochanan, this is talking about Noach. Call me Shenemer Bohaya Tzadiku Mitchiloso Vatsov. The Gemara says, the Medrash says, that Noach was a tzaddik. And the Medrash says, whenever it says the word Haya, that means that the person was a tzaddik from the beginning until the end. So the Medrash says, well, what do you mean? It says, Echad Haya Avraham. That Avraham is also referred to with this word Haya. Was Avraham always a tzaddik? Well, if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Avodos Kochavim, you will see one of the three most frightening words of Jewish history. And that is that Avram Avinu grew up in a house of idolatry, v'ru oved imayim, and he was part of it. He also worshipped. He also was part of that world. And what happens? He begins to look around. He begins to ask questions. He begins a metamorphosis of faith. He begins to grow as a person. And he begins to create this whole new reality, this ethical monotheism. He founds the Jewish people with all our values and our ideals. So how can you refer to him as Tzadiku Mitchiloso Vatsofu? He wasn't. He was this Ovid of Avodah Zarah who became a big tzaddik. The answer is that Avraham Avinu didn't become a big tzaddik and just sit in a base medrash. Avraham Avinu went out into the world and he inspired people, he uplifted people, he engaged people. You know how he was able to do that? He was able to do that because he had his own life experience with him. Avraham Avinu is tzadiku mitchiloso v'ad sofo because he took what he did wrong and he elevated it. Was Avraham Avinu always a tzadik? The answer is yes. Not because he never did anything wrong, but because everything he ever did wrong became part of his larger religious personality. And he learned from every single thing. That's the greatness of these people. Not that nothing ever went wrong. The Ramban says all over Sefer Bereishis that things went wrong. But nothing was just left. Things that went wrong became part of, look at the story of Yosef. Things that went wrong became part of the building blocks of the Jewish people. We don't just let them wither and let them die. We don't believe in bir hara. We don't believe in editing the bad parts. We believe in elevating them. And that's what the Ol Yaakov writes. And even HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, we're nearing the end here, even HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, the Medrash tells us, in an amazing medrash. The medrash says in source number 10, Yehi erev ein kisksiv kan elevayehi erev. Doesn't say that God said, let it be, it will be evening. It says, and it will be evening. Meaning something happened already. What happened already? Mikan shahaya seder zmanim kodim lakan amar Rav Avo. What does Rav Avo say? Milamed shahaya borei olamos umachrifon. Ad shabore es elim. That God actually created many, many worlds. And he destroyed those worlds until he created this world. He's God. God has to create and destroy and create and destroy. What was wrong with those worlds? You're God. You can't make a perfect world. What, you're creating, you're destroying? I always thought maybe those worlds, Brooklyn was too big. I don't know what bothered him about all those worlds. But he created worlds and he destroyed them. Until he created our world, says Rav Soloveitchik. What does that mean? What does that mean? Says Rav Soloveitchik, you know what that means? It means God was implanting within the Bria, within the universe, the notion, the reality of creative destruction. That when things go wrong, they go wrong for a reason, they go wrong to be built upon, they can be embedded within the foundational reality of moving forward. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed these worlds. Not because he messed them up, because he wanted us to understand that the nature of life and the nature of existence is that good things come from bad. Good things come from destruction. We grow from things going wrong. Sometimes it's very unfair that things are going wrong. It's very tragic, it's very hurtful, it's very painful, and we don't always understand, we rarely understand why this person was given this much wrong and that person was given that much wrong. We don't always know why that is, but what we do know is that when it happens, our response is to lift it up. And that's why Elul begins with the destruction of the Luchos. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to understand, you know how this process of introspection begins? You know what's greatness? Greatness isn't just Avraham Avinu. That's not greatness. Greatness is climbing up that mountain even though you fell down on your face the last time. Greatness is you come down from that mountain and you see catastrophe. And you break these luchos, and then God says, let's try it again, and you pick yourself up, and you climb right back up. That is greatness. That is Elul. Elul's not perfection. Yom Kippur, we're going to enter a zone of kapara, and atonement, and perfection, and pristine purity. That's not Elul. Elul isn't don't eat, don't drink, don't indulge in worldly pleasures. Elul is go to school, go to work, live life, but live life in a way and realize what's going on and recognize where the faults are and build on them. Confront reality. Recognize that everything can be a foundation to lift us up and to make us better people if we pay attention. And if we internalize. And that's what the shofar is really all about. You know, today's 9/11. Right? It's very hard for those of us who remember that day so clearly. I can tell you I was sitting in the YU Beis Medrash when the towers were hit. And I remember the run in Beitzah to the word, to the line that I was learning. And Rabbi Blau got up in the Beis Medrash and told us what happened. And then we all went to Belfer Hall, where we watched those buildings, those towers burn. From Belfer Hall, we could see it straight until security made us all leave because they didn't know what was coming next. And then they shut down the whole campus. And then the whole world and it was such a cataclysmic event to live through. You didn't even know what to do with yourself. And then talk about Elul, a week later it was Rosh Hashanah. We all have to stand on Rosh Hashanah with all of this going on. Things happen in the world. Things happen in life. Can't just let them go. Can't just let them happen. Can't say to yourself, that was evil, that was terrible. Let's get rid of evil. Let's get rid of terror. Let's get rid of anything bad and move on with our life. That's not how we give meaning to catastrophic events. We give meaning to catastrophic events by taking a minute and saying to ourselves, hey, do we feel that sense of vulnerability? Do we feel that sense of human, you know, compassion for loss that occurred? Do we recognize the heroes? Do we allow ourselves to confront terrible, bad mistakes, bad things that happen, because our goal in life is not to create this narrative of purity and perfection. Our goal in life is to lift up the things that happen, to allow them to inspire us and to motivate us. And we hear it so that we will all find that inspiration and that passion and that commitment, this Elul, to look back on the year, to recognize the challenges and the faults, and to climb that mountain again and ultimately reach the top and be able to create a life, a trajectory, and a future of impact and meaning and purpose for our own lives and for the entire Jewish people. Have a wonderful Ksiva v'Chasima Tova.